listening to the New Mamas Podcast. Hello, everyone. I hope you're having the best day. Today, we're going to be talking about newborn sleep, a hot topic in the mom world, and one with so many viewpoints and advice. Before I hit record, Kim and I were just kind of talking back and forth about all of that and how, you know, even though the world looks different today and it is a bit more accepting, it's also introduced so many more ways for us to be judged through social media. I'm sure a lot of you mamas are, you know, have felt that. But I have best-selling author and sleep expert Kim West, also known as the Sleep Lady, on with me today to share her advice specifically for newborn sleep. And spoiler alert, we are talking about alternatives to cry it out in this episode. Kim is going to walk us through a more gentle approach, which I really love. You're going to hear me reference her book, The Sleep Lady's Gentle Newborn Sleep Guide, because her team sent me her book a few weeks before our episode, and I had a chance to flip through it and read different sections. And I have to tell you, you know, I get a lot of these books from PR people, and I have to say, this one is actually gold, and we'll get into it. Kim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Lena. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right. Let's dive in. So I was talking about how much I love your book because when my son was a newborn, and for context, everyone, my son is 2.5 now. So although our newborn sleep days are over, we are actively trying for baby number 2. So I am hoping to use this guidebook to not get nap trapped or get into cluster feeding. There's so many things sleep wise that not to say I did wrong, but I think I could have had a more optimal experience. So part of it was because I thought sleep training meant cry it out or nothing. So I chose to do nothing.
Yeah. And you know, you're not alone.
Yes. That's the worst part.
That's really why I wrote this second book. So my first book addresses 6 months to 6 years, where I introduced my gentle sleep coaching approach. And even then, I wanted parents to feel like they could do something in between full extinction, full cry it out, to even time, what I call time checks, going in on increments, to doing nothing, suffering, or secretly co-sleeping. Like, not that I'm against it, but a lot of parents feel like they can't tell anybody. Like you've mentioned in a previous one of your podcasts, where a bunch of women sort of descended upon you when you said you were sharing their bed. And so I felt like those parents were coming to me being like, can I talk to you safely about this? Can you support us? Can you help us improve sleep while continuing to co-sleep? So I'm all about having parents having options and having gentle options.
That is so freeing. In your book, you write that you don't recommend cry it out for newborns because they're not developmentally ready to put themselves to sleep independently. That's one of the things that when I read that, I was like, I knew it, because instinctually when my son was a newborn, I had people recommend cry it out to me. Oh, you just got to leave him in the crib, let him cry. And it just didn't feel natural to me. And when I read that sentence in your book, I felt confirmed. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So without getting into, like, even though we can, nitty gritty science, I looked at it like even this. So I'm a family therapist for 30 years. And when I first went into my first internship in grad school, and I wasn't a mom yet, and I remember I was working with kids, and the thing to do, which people still do now, is, you know, time out. Right? Your kid has a temper tantrum. A, you're supposed to walk away from them. And B, after that, you're like, put them in a chair. Hopefully sometimes in a corner. I don't know. I don't really, you know, support that, but it's a little shaming, or very shaming. And then walk away. And I was always like, well, number one, what if they don't stay in the chair? And number two, what are they learning from that experience? I never could understand how they're learning to manage their big feelings. And so then fast forward to becoming a parent and, you know, and learning that sleep actually isn't, can be an issue, you know, just like breastfeeding. I don't know. I didn't find it as easy as I thought it would be. I thought it would be like, oh, just put them on your breasts and all work out. And same for sleep. And so, and at the time there really was, you know, what they call in America, ferverizing your baby, or full cry it out, or do nothing. And in the same, you know, idea came to me, like, how is my baby learning anything when they don't even, so I always try to think of this, which we talk, I talk more about in the book, that when our babies are born, they have a, are in a very primitive brain state. They don't have that sort of middle brain. And think about it even this way. They can't even, you know, bring their hands to their mouth yet in the beginning, yeah. Right? You know, that takes a few months. It's pretty spastic. They may get it there. It may not last. They don't even know yet how to close their eyes or turn their head away from something that, like an adult who's like too in their face or too loud. They don't know these things in the beginning, right? They don't literally have the skills to do it. And they have to learn them over time and when they're in a calm state. And so I've been so disturbed over my 30 years of working with parents in sleep at the messaging that parents receive around cry it out with your newborn. They're going to have lifelong problems. You know, you'll never be able to address it. They'll never learn how to self-soothe. And that's when I finally, 3 years ago, I edited my first book. I took out the newborn chapters to make room for this book to really just be on a, you know, I want to shout from the mountaintop, like, your newborn is not ready to learn to self-soothe. They need you to help them, to respond to them, to help bring them into a regulated, calm state so that they can start to learn, like, oh, this is what it feels like. Mm-hmm. Calm, soothe, relax. And then they even can begin to experiment again, not right away, you know, maybe in the second and third month. Oh, it feels good when I suck my wrist or a little blanket, or I learn to close my eyes and turn away. And as they learn more and more skills, we can start doing less and less and giving them a little bit more room. Right? It's this kind of relationship together that we're learning how to read our baby and they're learning how to communicate their needs, because they weren't born knowing how to do that. You know, when they were in utero, they got everything met for them.
whenever I thought of like my baby back in my belly, I'm like, oh, I could tell, like, that's such a nice place. And then we bring them out into this cold world. And I think, I love how you put that. And something about what I love about your method is another eye-opening thing that your book taught me was that addressing sleep alone isn't enough for our babies. And that resonated a lot with me because, again, I think as moms of newborns, we kind of think they're all just, we put them in a bucket, a newborn bucket, and we think every single baby, every single newborn is the same when it comes to sleep. And what your book taught me was that we actually have to look at the fast feeding,
elements,
soothing, and temperament. FAST, fast feeding, attachment, soothing, and temperament, because they all affect newborn sleep. Can you walk us through those four main factors?
You bet. So they all come under my approach of baby-led sleep shaping and coaching, because first we're setting a foundation in sleep shaping, and baby led, meaning that we're looking at our child's development and then we're making sure of all the fast elements. So feeding just means, of course, you know, our babies have like a teeny tiny stomach and the amount, you know, that they have to be well fed in order to be able to have their first longish stretch in the middle of the night, even if it's just 4 hours, which can feel fantastic initially, and that begins to expand. So we really have to focus on feeding. It's really, honestly, one of the first priorities in you know, with your newborn, making sure they're fed well. It's a way to avoid also, you know, what all kinds of other issues like reverse cycling, where they're eating a lot at night and hardly during the day, and they're getting their day nights confused. And so we focus on feeding. And then, of course, attachment. You know, our first task, and if you look at, you know, the Erikson theory, is trust, right? Trust versus mistrust is our first stage in life. And so that's where we begin the secure attachment. It's not like a one and done thing. It's really happens over a lifetime, but the first 3 years are pretty significant. Mm-hmm. And then they go through some other separation anxiety issues in adolescence. So we look at attachment and being responsive parenting, doing responsive parenting and responsive sleep coaching so that we are supporting and building that trust. And then soothing kind of goes to what I was saying earlier, that first we're going to respond. We might need to take a moment to do what I call in my book, SOAR. So, you know, stop, observe, assess, respond, right? Because not every time our baby cries is it because, let's say, they're hungry. We want to try to figure out, like, what time is it? How long have they been awake? When's the last time they ate? What's the environment? Is it something in their clothing or something that is making them physically uncomfortable? And then we try to appropriately respond. Sometimes we're going to get it wrong, right? That's just the nature of life and relationships. But trying to get that, you know, more and more in tuned. And so in soothing, our goal, because of that primitive brain in the beginning, is to just keep them calm so that they can take in their environment, be able to learn and not do what we talk about in the book is habituation, which we can talk about that too. It's how they sort of shut down to deal with overstimulation. Soothing's a big part of it. And then temperament. This is the one that I just feel like it's like neglected.
Yes.
As a significant, right? It's sort of like to your bucket theory, right? That everybody's like plopped into, you know, the same bucket. And this I find is pretty much all of parenting, right? You know, all the parenting advice. I mean, there is starting to be a little bit more books out there about spirited babies, like Mary Sheedy Kirchinka talks about sensitive kids, that kind of thing. Orchid and Dandelions are some books off the top of my head.
Oh, I never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. Very fat. I'd be happy to share some of those books with you and their titles, more thorough titles. So what I have found over the course of my work in the sleep world is that, you know, probably 70 to 80% of the families that came to see me had these babies or children that I called alert children, just really engaged with the world, really hard for them to shut the world out in order to, you know, go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be, you know, kind of dig their feet in a little bit as they get older, a little bit harder to parent. They keep you on your toes. I know I have one of these. And, you know, a little bit harder to get into, well, I should say a little bit harder for them to put themselves to sleep. And shut the world out because they're so like, oh, I want to look at everything. I want to be involved in everything. I don't want to miss out.
Interesting.
And I noticed, yeah. And with newborns, you know, the science says that we really don't start to see temperament, or they're not willing to put a name on the temperament until around 4 months of age. But anybody who's had one of these intense or alert or active babies, a lot of times they know in the first month. I know even my pediatrician said to me with my second one, oh, you got yourself a Tigger like Winnie the Pooh instead of Winnie the Pooh. I was like, what is that going to mean? I thought the second one was supposed to be easier. What do you mean? And that was like at the 2 week visit. So, you know, people know earlier. So we do know that temperament stays consistent throughout lifetime, right? You pretty much how it is displayed, I guess, you know, changes obviously. And so these kids who have, let's say, these intense or alert personalities or temperaments tend to not always be ready for sleep coaching, the same as their peers. you know, who might be, even though I hate some of these names, but the research gives them these names, these like more easy babies, that are more go with the flow babies. And it's hard then when you're a parent of one of these more alert babies, because it makes you feel like you're failing. Like, why is she having, you know, no problems and their baby's taking 3 hours sleep, and how come they did cry it out and that worked in two nights? We always hear that, by the way. Oh, they only cried 5 minutes and they slept through the night. Like, I love to say that baby has the best PR agent in the world, because that's not the majority. And so all of these things have to be taken into consideration when you're thinking about how can I improve the sleep for my family and for my baby. And most of the time when I share these things with parents, they tell me they're relieved, because almost like you said, you know, they instinctively felt like, that doesn't sit well with me. That doesn't seem right. Doesn't feel like my baby's ready to go 10 hours without a feeding at night at 6 weeks old, or I'm not comfortable with that level of crying, or my baby doesn't just cry, they scream, you know, for long periods of time. And so I think I just want to put a big, like, warm hug out to all the parents to say, it's okay. Let's not put our babies, let's use your metaphor, Lena, in a bucket. Let's really try to figure out who's my baby. And what's the best approach, and what are they ready for? Again, going back to that baby led.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And I feel like putting that in baby led as well almost takes the pressure off you as a parent, because I felt so much pressure too to almost mold myself into a sleep training style that I also wasn't ready for either. I had really bad postpartum anxiety. And the thought of leaving my baby in a separate room, I just could not do it. Like, would have rather, I don't know, name something really painful. Like, would have rather done that than go through that.
And there's nothing wrong. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that, because as you know, 15 to 20% of women globally experience PMAD, and then 25% of their partners will too.
Yeah.
I think that's the correct statistic. I mean, it's something that's important to talk about and important to factor in. You know, there's nothing, that's why you should room share or put a co-sleeper next to your bed or do safe co-sleeping. It should be the priority of the whole family's well-being.
Yeah. I love that your book mentions that too, and we'll get to it. But your book also, I don't see this a lot in these books. Mother self-care. Like, I actually, it's like in your first few, I think it's in your first chapter, like talking about
it is
why
in every chapter.
Oh, good. Yeah. I read that and I was like, okay, here's something I can really get behind, because now that I've been through it once, second time around, it's something I'm going to prioritize. That's actually the only thing I'm thinking about is not unfortunately, but I'm actually just thinking about me the second time around. I'm like, okay, how can we like best arm me and the family with help and support, so that way we can just all get through this together? But we'll get to the self-care, because I do want to talk about the five S's, because in your book, you talk about how soothing is important to comfort our babies in the moment, but also to support their healthy brain development for long-term growth. I actually didn't know that. So in there, you mentioned the five S's. Do you mind walking us through your best tips for soothing our babies?
So to always give credit where credit is due, the five S's come from Harvey Karp, the happiest baby on the block, big believer. There's also lots of things that we can do on top of the five S's, but the five S's are, let's see, sucking. So pacifier or some, when they get old enough, they like to suck on their hands or wrists or the fingers, whatever.
Yeah, so cute.
Swaying. Yeah, swaying. So oftentimes this way, swaying in a football hold. So tummy down and then left side tummy down. If your baby has reflux, that's even another little better secret. Let's see. So swaying, sucking, shushing. So white noise. Now all of a sudden, am I going to forget them all?
No, don't.
Oh, well, I kind of combined them. Side holding. So let me just go back to white noise. You know, they experience a lot of noise in the womb, right? They got the blood swooshing from our heart and our breathing and our voices pretty loud in the womb. So it makes sense, not to mention they have darkness. So let's see, swaying, sucking, side holding. Oh, swaddling.
Oh, yes.
Oh, good. You're looking it up to help me out.
swaddling. Have a book somewhere.
Thank you. Maybe it's in the index. And so swaddling, right? And mainly, and I know we can talk about swaddling for a while too, because I know some people are like, my baby hates it. The main idea is because they have the Mara reflex in the beginning, that startle response, like when you put them down, the swaddling helps hold them in like this, right? Think again about the womb, how the womb, they were sort of cocooned and saved and held tight. So did you find the fifth one?
No. But
okay.
I should have wrote it in my notes.
No. I mean, I should have this. It's just because I've been talking about it so much.
Well, and there's there's so many acronyms and that you mentioned SOAR, there's FAST, there's so many, but
I think it's also because I combined two, swaying and side holding.
Yeah. Oh, I love the side holding one. I didn't know that. I think a lot of parents are really overwhelmed in the newborn stage that we kind of forget to think back to, like you said, the primitive and what's almost I don't want to say common sense, but if you think about the womb, like you said, and how they are soothed in the womb, it's just taking that and trying to replicate it out here in the real world. And that's, I feel like but we're so in survival mode when we have this newborn that we really forget to bring it back to basics.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was writing this book, of course, I was having all these flashbacks of being, you know, with my babies and the good and the bad and or the good and the challenging and the crying. And, you know, you forget how much they cry. I was completely unprepared. You know, the average is 3 hours a day. Hopefully not all at once, but that's a lot, you know, in between. And so just going back and reading some of that research, and even if a listener just remembers that how their brain is so primitive, like imagine that if, you know, somebody in the kitchen drops a pan on the floor and it startles the baby, they don't know like, oh, everything's okay, dad dropped a pan in the kitchen. You know, they have no idea what that sound means or what's going to happen. And it's like that their whole day.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Which is why it's important to, you know, respond and to keep their environments really calm, which is why I have that sort of 3 p.m. rule, is that usually by sometime in the late afternoon, you know, which some people call like the bewitching hour, the witching hour, is, you know, they start to get more fussy. And think of it as, I'm tapped out on trying to process all these new things that I have no idea what they are. And so it's important that we, you know, try to calm their environment, put them in a quieter room. If the TV's on, turn it off, pull down the shades in the room. You don't have to make it pitch dark, but just make it more like spa-like if you can, so that they can regulate in a calmer environment, which is hard when you have an older child too.
Yes. Yeah, right. The 3 p.m. rule, it was something like in your book, it was between the hours of 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Like you mentioned, just really start to dial down that environment. And it's so funny reading that. Yeah. I thought, I do that. Like we do that now with our household. We really start to dial it down after a certain time and turn off electronics, put everything to charge in another room. turn on the humidifier, dim the lights, like the whole like sleep hygiene thing I'm really into now. And I'm really into it for myself. And if you think about it for you as an adult, aren't you like tapped out at certain times of like your day? Like I'm sure every mom has experienced like even being out at the mall or shopping and you're just, your brain is like, I call it mall glaze when you're just like, I'm done processing everything in my brain. I need to like get home.
Yes.
And our babies are the
same. I've never heard that saying. That's so great. I feel that way in the mall too. I'm like, why do I have a headache? Why? I just like can't I don't even know why I came here anymore.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Right. I would start crying too. I would scream to go home if I wasn't, you know, like self-aware.
Are you a new mom or soon-to-be mom finding yourself on Google to learn about all the unknowns and new experiences such as breastfeeding, teething, and more? If so, then Mama Wears Athleisure is the podcast for you. Episodes are designed to be short with experts to give you a starting point to go off of. Download Mama Wears Athleisure and watch for new episodes every Wednesday. Follow Mama Wears Athleisure wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Speaking about being overwhelmed, I remember getting home from the hospital with my son, right? So newborn, getting home from the hospital. My husband and I were absolutely just like panicked and stunned. My in-laws were there with the balloons and the welcome home. And I just remember like being a deer in headlights. That, I mean, I think everyone listening can remember that time of like, oh gosh, we're home. Now what? Like, what's your professional advice on how to transition from the hospital for those first few days at home?
Well, and some of it depends on what your experience was at the hospital and where you gave birth and if your baby was in NICU. But let's just say that your baby wasn't and you came home, whatever, the next day or three, you know, and of course, if you had a C-section, you're going to have to, you know, make some different steps too, just to make life easier for you, for yourself. I would, again, be thinking about the calm. Like I'd maybe not have a lot of people at the house when you, if you can avoid it. It's, and I know this is kind of cliche, but you really want to tell your friends and family how they can best support you.
Yep.
And usually the way they can best support you is like, bring over food, empty the dishwasher for me, throw a load of wash in, or really do household chores is the best thing to do. Maybe if the if your baby's crying and it's just, they don't need anything, they're just crying and you need a break, they could soothe the baby, take the baby for a walk and you take a nap. But most of the time in the first really two months, you need them to just help you at home. And I would also encourage visitors not to come at 3 to 7 p.m. when your baby will not be as friendly and you know, excited to have new experiences. And calm. So calm environment and calm, soothing environment, really.
I love
it's a lot to take in.
Calm, soothing. And if you all have a microwave at home, figure out how to turn the beeping off. That is my other piece. You know, like when a food is done and it goes,
that's
beep,
a good idea.
Beep, beep. Right. Oh my gosh. For some reason, I remember that triggering me so much because it would wake the baby every single time.
Right.
Any beeping.
Because again, that baby doesn't know that's the microwave beeping.
No. So I remember that drove me nuts. I was about to take a baseball bat to the microwave. I remember that.
I bet.
And okay, so another thing I remember was, and I think a lot of new moms get this, they get home with their babies and wonder, how long should this baby actually be sleeping? I remember my husband and I being like, how long did he sleep? Is he sleeping enough? Is he sleeping too much? Is there like a range for how long newborns typically sleep?
It's so hard. I think it was in I'm trying to remember what year that study was, quite a few years ago. They were finding that parents were getting very anxious about these numbers, like 11 hours or 12 hours or 15 hours or whatever. And so they started making big ranges.
I see.
Under 6 months, because we know that babies, you know, that can vary by huge amounts in the beginning. So what I'd like to share with your listeners is why that is. So first of all, part of it's temperament that only starts to be developed around, and I mean vague words like that, around 3 to 4 months. And then it really kind of cements a little bit more around 6 months and on. And it continues to develop until our children are somewhere in 2, 3, right? And then their sleep architecture starts to mimic ours. Even then, they're not always as good at sleeping late when they go to bed late. That's usually doesn't come till 7 or 8 years of age. So if we go back all the way to the beginning in that newborn phase, what I tell parents is, so if their internal clock, which is the circadian rhythm, which you and I have, that tells our body when to be asleep and when to be awake, and when it's time to be asleep, you know, we're supposed to have a calming environment that and have social cues. So a bedtime routine, or you and I, like you said, you do with your family, Lena, turn off, you know, turn the dial down, put away technology. And that tells the brain, oh, it's time to secrete melatonin, the drowsy making hormone, and get ready to go to sleep, right? Yay, so we love that. Okay. Love that. So they don't have that developed yet, right? So that's why we have to be what I call their external clock. So helping them to shape that environment and that sleep so that, you know, we have more frequent feedings during the day. We have more light exposure. It's a good idea in the second month to start regulating when we start our day. Initially, the bedtime is late. It really doesn't get moved earlier until maybe around the third month, again, around, because you have to go by your baby. So I feel like the first task, besides making sure your baby's feeding well, the second one is to help set this external clock expectations or stage to avoid day night confusion. So of course, some of the obvious ones are create a short but soothing bedtime routine around the same time. And you'll learn, you know, what that seems to be. A lot of times in the first month, it's around the parent's bedtime, you know, but which could be anywhere at that point from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., let's say. So you create that soothing routine. It's dark, it's dim lighting during the routine, and then lights off, room darkening shades, white noise, any feedings, diaper changes are done quiet, without a lot of, you know, hoopla. And then in the day, they even have great studies that show after feeding and, you know, changing that you go outside, get some natural light exposure. If it's, you know, cold, really cold where you are, even just making sure all the shades are opening. They say, you know, that our kids now spend so much time in buckets type seats and B with shades, you know, and so they're not really getting enough light exposure. Wow. And then the other part of that is, even though I know there's the saying, never wake a sleeping baby, this is my rule that's sort of against that. And that is wake a sleeping baby during the day, you know, if they've been sleeping more than 3 hours, because I don't want them to miss a feeding. And it's kind of like you're saying, oh, no, let's save those longer stretches for the nighttime. Get you feeding well during the day, right? Even though I know that doesn't sound like a long stretch, we're setting that foundation.
Oh, no. I remember when my son slept 4 hours, it felt glorious. Like that was, it felt like I got a full night of sleep. I remember that first time.
Yeah.
But you answered the question, because I was going to ask, should we wake our babies to eat? Because that's like a big one of like, do we wake the baby? So you're saying yes, if longer than 3 hours, because we don't want them to miss a feeding and we want to save those longer stretches for the evening. And how do we recognize our baby's hunger cues?
So, because I don't know if you were told this, but I feel like there's a lot of confusion over what is demand feeding. Mm. Yeah. I don't know if you were told this, right? I'm sure you probably were with your baby, do demand feeding. And then it's all about like, well, how do I know whether they want, right? Whether
they're hungry or not. Honestly, I just survival mode fed him whenever he looked like he wanted it. Like I think I popped him on the boob whenever he was fussy. I was like, you want boob? Okay. which I don't know if that was correct or not, but.
Well, but I bet you at some point you started figuring out, and not right away, not in the first 2 weeks as an example, or maybe even the first month, that wasn't always what he wanted or needed.
No. You know,
you might have popped, right? You probably popped him on the boob sometimes and he was like, no, or
he did
1 minute
soothe,
of sucking and then
sleep.
Yeah.
Actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I was going to ask you about how not to get nap trapped. That was going to be my next question.
Okay. Well, let me tell you a few of the hunger cues, because there are some. Again, when your baby cries, again, I do soar, stop, observe, assess, respond, because babies cry for a lot of reasons, not always for hunger. And you'll start to figure that out as they start to learn to differentiate their cries. They don't know how to do that in the beginning either. So if you feel like I have no idea how to read my baby in the beginning, I promise you it's okay. You're not alone. It's just, we're all just kind of getting to know each other, right?
Yeah.
So some of the common ones are licking their lips, sticking out their tongue, rooting is a great one because that reflex goes away at around 3 months. So
what's rooting?
So when you get something close to their mouth or nose, they start making that symbol of like, where's the bottle?
Oh,
where's the nipple?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so you'll know immediately, putting their hand to their mouth, if they can do it. They can't do that in the very beginning. And of course, fussiness and sucking on everything, if they're capable of that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and then two, looking at how long was the last time they fed. Knowing, and I'm, by the way, make sure that we separate this from that afternoon, evening time when it's really common to have cluster feeding, again, is a way to like calm ourselves down, calm the baby down. So don't worry about that, but practice looking for the hunger cues earlier in the day so you can start to differentiate.
That's really good advice. So back to being nap trapped, and this is probably related. This is related probably. So when my son was a newborn, I ended up getting nap trapped. A lot of moms listening probably went through this. I was breastfeeding and my son would feed, fall asleep. And every time I would try to take him off the boob, or the boob would, nipple would fall out. He'd fall asleep. And then I tried to put him into a crib or a bassinet or whatever. He would wake up or he would sleep for only 20 minutes at a time. I think a lot of us fall into this cycle. And although I treasured a lot of those moments where he did nap in my arms and I watched, you know, binge watched reality TV, I think that also those moments didn't allow me to take care of myself, which you mentioned in the book. I didn't, wasn't able to eat nutritiously, move my body, or even just hydrate and get a glass of water. So how can new moms ensure that they don't get nap trapped in the newborn stage?
You know, I really like the idea of having a toolkit of soothing tools, I guess, like a toolbox, I should say, so that you don't feel like the only way I can soothe my child is with my nipple. Because then you're really confined. It even makes it hard for your partner to soothe them, you know, or a parent or whoever who's there. So even if it's, I hand you over and, you know, your other parent rocks you to sleep, at least we're getting some variety, right?
And that's good.
Or I put you into it. That's good.
Okay.
Yeah. Because then it's not, oh, the only way I can go to sleep is to be nursed to sleep. I can also be rocked to sleep. I could be put in a carrier. I could, you know, a swing, a stroller, or that kind of thing. But one little trick that you actually said was you said that you noticed the pattern. You'd only sleep 20 minutes. So usually what I tell parents is, if you're going to hold the feed and hold the baby to sleep and then try to transition them back, you have to hold them for longer than 20 minutes. So they enter into a deeper sleep and it's easier to put them down. I would also say put them down swaddled. So you might want to be, you know, depending on like if you can get them into deep enough sleep that you could then, like, for instance, if they had the sleep sack or the love to dream where you don't even have to worry about it because they already have arms up and they can still, you know, touch you. Granted, it does have fabric on their hands. But if you have the swaddle sacks with the wings, you can have the wings undone and they're nursing and they can touch you. And then as they're falling asleep, you put the wings on.
Oh, I see.
And then hold them until you get past the 20 minutes until they're in that deeper phase of sleep and less likely to startle awake, which is what you did with your arms, right?
Yes.
And then be able, and then you could even like help like jiggle and help them make it into that next sleep cycle and stay asleep.
Golden advice. Like, absolutely love that. And I think we can't talk about newborn sleep without touching upon SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, because it's a lot, it's something that a lot of moms of newborns fear. So let's talk about SIDS. Oh yeah, that was my personal story. I remember sobbing to my provider in my six week appointment about, like, we were trying to talk about my care. And I was like, she's like, how are you doing? And I remember sobbing, being like, I'm doing great. But I was I remember telling her, I'm so scared of SIDS. Like, that was my number one fear. So how can moms help lower the risk of SIDS?
So I have in my book, and you can also go to firstcandle.org. And of course, they have this listed in on the American Academy of Pediatrics. But, you know, they have this kind of nice list of 10 things, right? You know, always put the baby on their back, and they talk about it in a crib or a bassinet that's a flat surface. There's no, it's a tight fit from the mattress to the railing, no blankets, no pillows, no stuffed animals, no things that can fall on your baby's face, make it hard for them to breathe. Remember, they are not capable of pushing things off of them yet or rolling. You don't also want them to be overheated. So a lot of times if you live in a hot climate, having a fan, making sure, or having air conditioning or some, making sure they're properly dressed so that they're not being overheated, that parents aren't, you know, smoking in the environment is a big key factor. If you are going to co-sleep, then, you know, you have to do it safely, which we could have a whole nother discussion about that. And then no sleeping on couches, you know, I mean, of course there is a difference between sudden infant death and suffocation. And lots of the cases can be, you know, suffocation, right? They fall in between you and the couch and, or the armchair and suffocate. And then there's SIDS where it's sudden infant death. They could be in a safe crib. Unfortunately, you know, that's the really scary part.
Yeah. And exactly. Like, it's good that we just address it and talk about it. You can look up the rules for safe sleep by the American Association of Pediatrics. Do you recommend oxygen trackers such as the Owlet or the Nanit camera? Like, how do you feel about them as a sleep consultant professional?
You know, my concern about them is the incredible anxiety that they give parents. Not to mention the EMFs of the devices. We just don't really know that much about it. The electromagnetic fields, you know, from the Bluetooth devices themselves.
For sure.
But I don't know. That's my biggest concern. I think it feeds into anxiety. I mean, if your child was born premature and they had apnea, they'll probably come home with a device, you know, that will like ring a bell and wake you up out of your sleep if the baby has stopped breathing. And then usually once they're out of that worrisome period, they tell you not to use the apnea monitor. So I'm not a really big proponent if you're doing it out of your own anxiety, but I think that you have to, I would encourage you to talk to your pediatrician, make sure your sleep environment is safe, and then, you know, kind of make an informed choice and say, is this helping me and my baby, or is this making it harder for me? And is this something my baby needs?
Yeah, I don't think you're alone.
Sorry to those companies.
No, I mean, that's why I ask, because I've actually gotten the similar response from every professional I've spoken to is it tends to just enhance mothers and new parents' anxiety. So I used the outlet. I also struggled with postpartum anxiety. I don't know if it helped or hindered. It didn't help. So it's interesting, but always have to bring it up. So let's finish off our conversation. You have it bolded in your book that doubling down on mama self-care, mom's mental and physical health, is directly connected to supporting the sleep needs of our babies. I feel like this is a no-brainer now that I'm out of it and thinking about number two. But when we are in the thick of it and in that survival mode, we're not thinking about ourselves. So do you want to elaborate more?
Well,
on
and
your
we don't live
that?
In a, I feel like there's very few cultures left now that support the family in the first 3 months of just, and really it's more than that, but really, I mean, there are cultures that, and even that's starting to go away as globalization, but that the first 3 months, it's like you barely left the house. You had other people cooking, cleaning, caring for you, and your main task was just to bond, connect, rest, restore, eat all the healthy things, you know, and not further deplete yourself. But we've now gotten to the point now where when we're pregnant, it's all about the mom or the birth mom. And then you have the baby and it's no longer about her and it's all about the baby. And then, you know, we wonder why we're all depleted and exhausted. And then, you know, of course, at least in the United States, so many parents go back to work 6 weeks after having a baby, right? Yeah.
That was me.
Exactly.
I was fortunate enough to work from home and be able to do work on the computer on video calls. So I had my newborn on calls, and even being fortunate enough to work from home and have my baby at 6 weeks at home, it was still brutal. Yeah. I love that you mentioned that. Like some other cultures, I know that the first 40 days, I think, or 100 days are considered sacred, and the mother isn't allowed to see anyone and leave the house. And I'm like, wait, that sounds great. How do we make that a thing? Because I would have loved, as much as I loved having some of the help, I would have also loved to not see anyone in that period.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think that there's a great book, another great book, The Postpartum Depletion Cure, by Oscar Serloc. He's a physician in Australia, and he talks about this after treating thousands of moms who he saw depleted. Now, he makes a difference between depletion and postpartum mood and anxiety. You know, not that you can't have both. And he talks about how important it is that we take care of ourselves. I mean, it is, even though I know we all hear it as moms, and maybe some of us like me would roll our eyes, like, yeah, whatever, when the oxygen mask comes down, put it on my mouth first. Okay, fine, I did it, you know, but we're not really caring for ourselves. And this affects, you know, our own physical health, our mental health, and our babies are in the beginning think that and feel that they are one with us. You know, we are together in this. And so it's so, you know, there really is something to like, come mama, come baby, you know, that it, what we do and feel really affects them, which makes sense, you know. We just forget about it, like you said, and focus only on our babies. But I fought hard to keep that section in the book, even though we wanted to make the book smaller. But I just thought it was so essential. I feel like it's, I didn't want to be part of that movement, you know, it's only about the baby.
Right. Part of it is like cliche and you see it all the time, but yet at the same time, we're still seeing a huge emphasis on what the nursery looks like, or like what kind of crib sheets, or what's the outfit coming home from the hospital, and the registry being all about, you know, all about the baby, which I get it. But really what mom needs is a couple meals, like the meal. Oh, gosh, the meals, like having new. I remember like when my mom came when my son was a couple weeks old, and I remember just her cooking a meal that wasn't like fast food or pizza.
Yeah.
It felt like such a luxury to have like a vegetable. Yeah. It was so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love, you know, so your book is a perfect length.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. I did have to cut some out there, but you know, but still, I'm happy to have, and all the components I thought was essential. I also have, by the way, in case your listeners may like this, a digital planner that has some tips from the books. It's free. And in it, in the back of it are printable resource sheets. And some of them are things like what your friends and family can do to help you. You can make a little list, right? You know, and you print it out and put it on the refrigerator and like, can you please help me do these things?
Ooh,
and meal
that.
Planning. Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of your friends, like a lot of your friends and your family will want to help. They do. Mm-hmm. So even though it is uncomfortable to say like, here's how you can support me during this time, they'll be more happy for it because they probably will like try to help you in some regard, even whether it's buying diapers or anything. Yeah. So help guide them. I love that. I think I saw that free printable. And for everyone listening, I will include all of the links in the show notes, including how you can get Kim's book. And Kim, tell us where we can buy your book and then also where everyone can find you online.
Yeah. So if you go to sleeplady.com, you'll see all my resources from newborns to 6 years old. I even have a potty training and potty coaching if you are a listener with an older toddler. And the newborn book is right on there on sleeplady.com/newborn sleep guide. But if you just go to Sleep Lady and check them out, you'll see the newborn book there. And if you pre-order it now, it's coming out March 21st. You'll get my a preview of the course for free. You'll get my planner and some of the printables and PDFs from the book. Oh, and a free chapter.
Ooh, I love that. And what I love about your book is that it doesn't feel intimidating. Like it just feels like everything. And I know this shouldn't matter, but the text is like a really good size. Everything is spaced in a way that it's not overwhelming. It's not a book that you pick up and you're like, oh gosh, this is a dictionary. I can't do it. It's a book that you can really open up and almost flip through and find these cute little boxes that give you these really fast tips. And there's also these really great diagrams. For example, there's introducing a bottle diagram. There's another really great diagram in here that I saw that I was like, I need to blow that up and hang that up. But yes, for all
thank
the
you.
Yeah, no,
I really,
seriously.
That was so important to me, you know, because I know that when we have a newborn, we're tired. We don't have a big attention span, nor should we. And because of all the brain changes we're experiencing after having a baby, that I wanted it to feel like digestible and actionable.
It is. Yeah. And you also break up your book through by months as well. So you don't have to read the whole book in one sitting. You can really follow it as a true guide for as your baby gets older. So that's what I really love about it. I'm keeping this for my future baby number
please
two.
Please do. Awesome. And do, you know, I will tell parents, please don't get too hung up in the months of the age. Remember, we just did that as like a guideline because you have to organize it somehow. Think of it more like stages. So you may feel like, oh, my baby just turned 3 months, but they still really feel like a 2-month-old. That's okay. Just stick with the 2-month-old and see what's going to happen next so that you know when your baby seems like they're more in that next stage.
Ooh, I love that. Well, Kim, thank you so much for giving us all your goodies and being on the podcast today. We really loved having you.
Thank you. I love being here.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Lena.
Yeah, you're welcome. Everybody, check out the show notes for all the goods, the free resource guide, and catch us back next week for the next episode. Bye. Thanks for joining us this week on the New Mamas Podcast. This podcast was created to help first-time moms everywhere navigate this new stage of life and talk about the honest and the raw moments in motherhood. I'm your host, Lena Forrestal. I'm a working mom by day and a blogger, photographer, and podcaster by mid-afternoon. And as a first-time mom myself, I'm on this journey with you. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And if you did, be sure to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite listening platform. You can donate to the show at buymeacoffee.com/newmamaspodcast. Stay in touch by following us on Instagram at New Mamas Podcast and Lena Forrestal. Thanks again, and stay tuned next week for the next episode. Bye.